Tape 2, Side 2 continued.
We couldn't be married in California because I couldn't get enough time off. You had to have a blood test in California. It took about 3 days. And I never knew when I would have time off. This colonel wasn't about to let me, the colonel who ran the cadre pool, his name was McGowan. And McGowan wasn't about to let anybody off for any length of time because we had so much to do. So finally, when he did give me 3 days off, we drove to Las Vegas and were married in the Justices of the Peace's office in Las Vegas with a couple of witnesses from that office present. And then, of course, had a day or so in Las Vegas and had to drive back to Riverside. By that time, most of the officers that I had been with had left that room. And so Maxine and I occupied room 501 at the Remission Inn after we were married. And then, in our great innocence, she was pregnant almost immediately. I think that actually our firstborn was born, because she was about 3 weeks early, born about 8 months and 12 days or something after we were married.
Where was she born?
Hmm?
Where was she born?
Oh, he. Bill Jr. Well, I'll tell you about that. When Maxine was pregnant, I thought, gee, you know, I could ship out of here any day. And I think that I'd love to be here for the birth of my child, if it's possible. So across my desk came a document asking people to apply for Far Eastern Military Government, in which you would go to the University of Virginia to study military government for 6 weeks, and then study Japanese for 6 months. That sounded very interesting to me, and it would keep me in the U.S. until the child was born. So I applied for that and was accepted, and we left in August of 44 for Charlottesville, Virginia. We were there, and then they were teaching Japanese at about 6 American universities. And I suppose, based on old loyalty, I applied for Yale and got it. And so we went to New Haven, and that's where our son was born, and at the Yale Hospital in New Haven. And I studied Japanese there. They had a very good course with a philologist who talked to you about the theory of the language, and Nisei tutors who taught the actual use of the language. So if you had a question about usage, or pronunciation, you had to talk to your Nisei tutor. But if you wanted to talk about sentence structure or grammar or so forth, you had to talk to the philologist who spoke to you. But anyway, we completed that in May, I guess, of 45, and were assigned to the Presidio of Monterey to wait shipment. So we drove out to Monterey, and that was a madhouse. Fort Ord had 60,000 troops, and the Presidio of Monterey was crowded, and it was almost impossible to get a place to stay. And we had, through some friends in San Francisco, they had reserved 2 days at a motel here, and then we had to get out 3 days at a motel here, and then we had to get out, all with this child. It was really, it was hectic.
That's hectic.
So anyway, we finally, Maxine said, "Oh, I think I'd like to stay here while you're overseas." So we looked around and bought a little house. It was a little box on and the Carmel Heights, and near the Carmel Mission. And it turned out to be a very, very comfortable little house. And I think we were lucky to have it during, and we had it until I got back, and then I stayed a few months, and then we sold it and came back. And then that was when we came back to Pittsburgh.
Where did you go overseas?
I went with a boatload of these people who had been trained in Japanese and in various and had been trained in certain areas of Japan. And we went and we sat in Yokohama Harbor with all these other boats right after VJ Day, and found out that MacArthur didn't want any of us. He wanted his people who had come from the Philippines and Okinawa with him, and you can't blame him for that. And so we sat there, and sure enough, we were assigned to Korea. And so we went where the Inland Sea was still mined, and they were still clearing the mines from the Inland Sea. So we went around the tip of Kyushu and over to Incheon and landed in Incheon. And stayed in a deserted TB hospital, camped out there, and waited for instructions, and finally were assigned to various areas in Korea. And the group I was with was assigned, we were the a military government company, and we were assigned to 4 counties in Gangwon province. And with the headquarters in Wonju. Wonju was a railhead, which was...
Would I be asking too much to spell those places?
W-O-N-J-U.
W-O-N-J-U. And what province?
Gangwon province is K-A-N-G-W-O-N, I think. About, Wonju is about, I would say, 70 miles southeast of Seoul. And I was in Korea in military government for about 10 months and came back and was released from the service at Camp Beal, B-E-A-L-E, in California. Yeah, not too far from Sacramento, I think. June, around the June 10th, something like that, of 1946. And I went back, to our little house in Carmel, and we put it on the market, sold it rather quickly, and came back to Pittsburgh in August. We had a... Maxine had never been to Pittsburgh. We took a small suite at the Shenley Hotel. And it was a hot August day when we arrived. We came in by train from Chicago and arrived first thing in the morning, went to the Shenley, and we ordered breakfast, and I opened all the windows. I ordered a glass of milk for our little boy, who then was 22 months, I guess, something like that. And she took him in to change him. And when she came out, on the glass of milk was a nice film of soot. You know.
I do know.
And she shuddered and said, "My God, do we have to live here?" And I said, "Well, this is where the job is." And so we were very happy when Dave Lawrence supported smoke control. And I got back to Pittsburgh, as I say, in August of, late August of 46. My brother had had a falling out with Oliver Keller, who was the editor. My brother wanted to support Dave Lawrence for mayor. But Oliver Keller, who was a good, strong Republican stock, and took very seriously all the accusations against Dave Lawrence about gravel scandals and other things in his previous political activities, and was darned if he was going to support Lawrence. So the paper supported Lawrence's opponent. And my brother was very disgusted and told him so. And so I guess he felt that his future at the paper with my return probably was not as secure as it had been.
Had your brother taken over then?
Oh, he was running the company. But, you know, he had settled in Toledo. After, he was at Mellon Institute for several years during the war, and then about 44 or 45, I don't know exactly which date, he left the Mellon Institute and went to Toledo and later bought a house there and built a laboratory next door where he did some of his chemical research work. And he was obviously a good chemist. I'll tell you something about that later. Getting back to coming back, Oliver Keller announced to me very shortly after I got back that he had bought a radio station in Springfield, Illinois, with the help of some other Pittsburghers. It was the home of his wife's family, Springfield, Illinois. And he bought a station there, and he was leaving the Post-Gazette. And I had the tough decision. Here I was. I'd been out of the newspaper business for 5 years of military service, 41 to 46. And, you know, I probably should have hired somebody and not tried to run it myself, but I suppose I felt that I should cut my teeth in this work. So I didn't. I went ahead to try to do the job that Keller had been doing, and that was hard for me, especially at first. Well, you know, I've been connected with the Post-Gazette then ever since 46, which is 47 years, a long time.
And, smiling as though it was fun.
Oh, it's been very interesting. I mean, I wouldn't change for the world. Newspaper business is fascinating, and it's minding everybody else's business. It's an interesting, and every day is a different day. Every day is new, and it's a little bit different from making screws and bolts, I think. But I'm sure that every undertaking has its interest because of competition and the various things that happen. But you know, we inherited a six-day morning newspaper against Hearst owning a seven-day evening and Sunday, and Scripps Howard a seven-day and evening and Sunday. And it was a very, very difficult very difficult undertaking. They could raise their Sunday prices for advertising, for circulation, not touch their daily situation. And I would be left hanging there trying to find ways to get increased income as our costs rose through inflation and union negotiation, etc. So it was very difficult over a long period of time. And in the middle 50s and late 50s, it became more and more difficult, and we began to lose money. So, but the Hearst people were having very serious troubles too. And so I was able to make, I had been talking to the Hearst people long before, suggesting some kind of a merger with them where we would operate an all-day paper and a Sunday against Scripps Howard, and maybe that would be competitively advantageous. But they weren't interested in that. And they wanted to buy us. And, you know, I had this emotional connection with it. It had been in the family since 1927 and so forth. So we had this, it was difficult to, emotions can make you make some bad decisions, I think. But anyway, we weren't interested in selling out to Hearst. So finally we bought Hearst in 1960. Thinking that we could have a morning and Sunday, and that would be successful. But unfortunately, the Hearst Sunday paper had been slipping very rapidly against Scripps Howard. Scripps Howard had the press had the solid Allegheny County popular circulation, and Hearst had circulation all over the map. And not very solidly in the city. And in those days, advertisers, malls weren't open yet. Advertisers were interested in downtown sales, Kaufman's, Horn's, Gimbel's.
Meyer Johnson's, Rosenblum.
Right. Rosenblum and Frank and Cedar.
That's right.
They were interested in city and county circulation, and that's what the press was strongest in, and the Sun-Telegraph weakest. And so when we acquired the Sun-Telegraph, we found that their Sunday paper had been slipping very, very badly. And actually, it hurt us more than it helped us in trying to overcome our problems. So we knew that Scripps Howard was involved in joint operating agreements in a number of cities. And we approached them about the possibility of a joint operating agreement. And they were very much interested because through such an arrangement, we would have to drop our Sunday, which we had inherited from the Sun-Telegraph. And they would have the only Sunday, and they could taste that. They thought that was going to be great. So that's what happened. And in 1961, in November of 61, we entered into a joint operating agreement with the Scripps Howard, which was to last to the end of the century. And it worked very well for a number of years. It was slipping some in recent times. And we weren't too happy with the way they were conducting their business and the way they were treating us. And they obviously were looking toward the end of our arrangement at the end of the century, and when they would not renew the agreement, and they would be the only ones in the field. I'm sure they were looking to that day, so they weren't trying to build us in any fashion. And under the operating agreement, you know, there were provisions of things that they were supposed to be doing to maintain our position in the field. Well, we were getting very unhappy when along came this strike in 92. it was obvious that the press, their strategy was that they felt they had to reduce costs in order to create the kind of margins that were necessary to build a new facility, because the presses here are getting quite old. And they wanted to improve their cash flow, and they saw it, they didn't see increased revenues coming too easily. They thought that they had to reduce costs. So they tackled the Teamsters Union, which frankly has been a very expensive distribution system. And their strategy was absolutely right. Their tactics were terrible. And, you know, when they announced that they wanted to eliminate 450 jobs from the Teamsters Union, who only had 620 members, how can you ask a union to vote out two-thirds of their jobs? How can you get a majority vote in your favor? Can't do it. And it just, they tackled, their tactics I think, quite poor, even though what they wanted to do made sense. Well, you know, the outcome of that was that they finally got disgusted because they couldn't come to an agreement with the union, although they had made a lot of progress. And the union had agreed to 260 buyouts, in other words, reduction by 260, which was quite an accomplishment. And when we started to negotiate with the union, we accepted that figure and said, let's go from there. So anyway, the Scripps Howard people apparently decided that they didn't want to battle it any further, and they wanted out. And on October 2nd, they announced that they were going to sell the press. We were in quite a difficult situation, actually. We had just put in new presses in Toledo at considerable cost, and we were in greater debt than we'd ever been as a family operation. We had built a new building and put in a new press in the paper in Monterey, California that we had bought in 1967.
When you were sharing the presses here,
Pittsburgh. Yes. So we had to figure out a system of making an offer to the press that was not going to include a great increase in our debt. And so, you know, part of our offer was to trade them the Monterey paper, which we valued highly, and which other people have not valued quite so highly, but we think it was quite valuable. And we had spent a great deal of money on a new building and a new press. We designed an offer which they eventually accepted. And they accepted it with certain provisos. Number one, that we complete the negotiations with the unions by November 30. And they accepted our offer on October 28th. I think we signed a letter of intent then. And so they were giving us just a little bit more than a month to complete with 10 unions. 13 contracts, I think. And that was something that I thought would be impossible. But we found that the unions were very anxious to terminate the strike. It had gone on far too long. And they wanted labor peace. They thought we were fair people. And the enemy was Scripps Howard. I mean, they had built up a tremendous animosity to the press. And so we were able to accomplish that. We put in a whole new team of negotiators, and nobody that the press had used. And they were very responsive and very helpful. And we were able to complete the negotiations and sign all the contracts on November 30. Then we had to complete the financing, I think, by December 15th was the proviso of the agreement, which we were able to do. And we had to get approval of the antitrust division of the Justice Department, because any merger above a certain figure is under their jurisdiction, under the Rodino Act. Well, that you have to provide the antitrust division with a great deal of information, and we were able to provide them that by November.
You were working day and night.
November 17th. Yes, it was a grueling period. And November 17th, we provide them. They had 30 days to decide. And if after 30 days they approved it, why, we were home free. Or if they disapproved it, they would ask for more information. And then they would have the right, after we provided the more information, to have 20 more days. Well, on December 17th, they notified us that they wanted more information. They sent us a 26-page document, and asking for more information. We were pretty well prepared for this because we had checked into other situations, and this was boilerplate that they had sent to other people. And our lawyers were pretty well prepared. They met with them and narrowed down the areas that they really wanted. And then they started to take depositions. Oh, we provided all the information they wanted by December 24th. Meantime, they were beginning to take depositions, and they deposed the general manager of the press and the president of Scripps, and I was deposed for 5 hours on December 28th. They had a group of three lawyers and two economists who sat in on these meetings. We had several lawyers. And it was an interesting process, but very frustrating, very frustrating. And we didn't know where it was going to take us. But finally, as I say, I have to take my hat off to them. They worked through the whole holiday period. They took depositions on the 23rd, the morning of the 24th of December, and I was on the 28th, and so was John Craig. And we just didn't know what was going to happen. And of course, meantime, we were trying in every way to get some decision. You know, we appealed to Senator Specter and Senator Wofford, and the usual things you do to try to get something accomplished. Well, December 30 was one of the most roller coaster days I've ever spent in my life. Our advertising agency, handles public relations too, decided that it was time that we had a press conference. And I said, well, we have nothing to say. Well, you've been out of the news too much, and opponents have been talking and so forth, and you ought to at least outline the situation. So at 10 o'clock, well, we had all the radio and television people in here, and we were still, of course, on the fourth floor where our Post-Gazette quarters were. This was all press down here. And So on the fourth floor in the newsroom, all the radio and TV, and I tried to outline the situation. When they asked questions, there was very little we could say. We're waiting for word from the Justice Department and so forth. 3 o'clock that afternoon, we're notified that the whole deal has been approved without exception. And of course, the elation was just absolutely breathtaking. I mean, the people were just beside themselves with joy, and champagne was flowing and so forth. They were so happy. Because our editorial room upstairs was very... See, the Post-Gazette only had an editorial operation. We had about 150 people, a very intimate relationship. Well, they were cheering and happy as could be because, you know, they thought probably they were not going to have jobs. And suddenly the thing turns around and Jonah has swallowed the whale. You know, and they're beside themselves. And of course I was feeling very good, and I went home. And I get home and there's a telephone call from California. Our daughter was in an automobile accident and her little boy was in the hospital being operated on.
So end of side two, tape two. Will you mark where we are ending?
Yes.
Little boy was in the hospital.
Yes.
Okay. To be continued on tape three.